I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast.
Hi, everybody. It's Jason Klom, host of the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. I'm honored today to have Tommy Chong on the phone with me. Thank you so much for doing this.
Hey, my pleasure. Nice to be in somewhere. Where am I?
You're in Burbank right now. Let's say you're in Burbank.
Okay, Burbank. Okay, because I just got back from Berlin.
Oh, did you?
I was in Germany. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I like Germany is wunderbar. It's really nice.
It's beautiful. I lived there as a kid because my parents were in the military, so I miss Germany a lot.
Oh, so you did. Where, Berlin?
No, the biggest, but the city we were in the longest was Wiesbaden. I don't know how large it is, honestly. I should know, but I don't. But it's very pretty as on an Air Force base, but it's honestly, it's just so beautiful. I miss it a lot.
Oh, yeah, I love it. You know what I love most of all is when you fly on Lufthansa Airlines,
uh-huh.
the announcer, they talk quiet.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? It's so annoying. You get on a plane and, you know, and you get all this, fasten the seatbelt, to take the, you know, all that crap. you don't want to hear that, you know?
Sure.
So Lufthansa. Yeah, well, all of Berlin is very, very civilized.
Uh-huh. Okay, so I want to, I, you know what, let's start here. I don't know, I know, the only part I really know about your history is, you know, that you started out as a musician. Obviously, there's a lot more to your life than that. You started out as a musician, and eventually you meet Cheech Marin, and it seems like that's history. But what were your comedy influences early on if you were a musician first?
Well, my earliest comedy influence was Red Fox. When I was really young, we used to go to this dump. It was an army, like an army base. It was
uh-huh.
like a dump. They never had, back in the 40s and 50s, they never really had a kind of garbage collection.
Uh-huh.
They just had a dump that you would take and dump all your stuff there. And we found, you know, we'd scavenge around there, and I found a Red Fox party record, they called it, the 78.
Yeah.
And that was my first taste of recorded comedy, and we couldn't play it in front of our parents, but
sure.
When we played it, it was very X-rated and so much fun. And so Red Fox was really my earliest, and plus like I grew up in the 40s, 50s, and so we had radio, you know, the Amos and Andy and Jack Benny and Bob Hope. And so I'd listen to the radio shows,
yeah,
and I'd hear the comedians, you know, all the comedians, and then Ed Sullivan. So and my dad loved to, you know, he loved to be funny. He
yeah.
loved to laugh. I grew up in a very comic driven childhood.
Yeah. Now at that time, so I mean, I know you're born in Canada. So you're in Canada at the time though when you find that record.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm in Calgary, Alberta,
Calgary,
Canada.
Alberta. Okay, and so was there? I mean, it's funny because every influence you listed that I heard was American. Was there any Canadian comedy to speak of that you knew about?
There was a pair of guys called Wayne and Schuster.
Oh yeah, sure.
They Wayne and Schuster. They were the hot, funniest comedians that Canada had. You know, they had that like Martin and Lewis. It
mm-hmm.
was Wayne and Schuster. And I think the daughter, I think Rose went on to become a big, well-known producer.
Okay.
You know, I think she was on the what's that show at night? Saturday Night Live. I think she was one of the original writers.
Wow.
I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. So that's all right. This is one of those things. Where I think if you grew up in Canada at a certain time, it seems like it depends on when you grew up there. Your influences could be heavily American regardless.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Or European.
Sure.
You know, European, you know, anybody like vaudeville was still happening, you know, when I grew up.
Sure.
And so there was, you know, anybody that was on Ed Sullivan was from vaudeville. And the thing is about vaudeville, like I went to the Crazy Horse Saloon in France when we shot a movie here in 1980, And the Crazy Horse Saloon would have these comics. They were like mime artists because no one spoke, you know, a common language. And so they'd have to be funny with movement, you know, like Charlie Chaplin. And so I picked up a lot of influence from the vaudevillian comics.
Yeah. That's amazing. And was that influence laying dormant as you're a musician, or were you doing anything comedically before Cheech and Chong?
Well, when you're a musician in a black band, which I was, you're in a constant state of humor. You know, you're just laughing all the time because we would, you know, play the dozens, you know, we'd out each other. You know, and whether you want it to be or not, like when I was with Motown, my nickname was Hey Chinaman.
Oh my God.
Hey Chinaman. In fact, that's what Bob Marley said to me one time when we opened for Bob Marley and the Wailers, and we went to the rehearsal, and we walked into the dressing room, and it was just smoke filled, looked like a Cheech and Chong movie. And out of the darkness, I heard that, "Hey, Chinaman, say something funny, man."
Oh, my God. Wow. Yeah, well, I mean, I did read, you never know how true this stuff is, so I guess I can ask you. I did read that you supposedly came up with an alternate name for one of your bands.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, we never had a band name. You know? That's the way we were, you know. We had a nightclub, we had a place to work, but no official name.
Okay.
With Motown, so we're joking around, and that's where we come up with Four Niggers in a Chain. Is my wallet over there? Parents? Oh, I got, you know, I'm looking for my wallet. It is in my ear. It's in my phone. It's attached to my phone.
Oh my God! So I guess Little Daddy and the Bachelors was an easier name to sell. Is
well, Little Daddy and the Bachelors. I never named that. That was Tommy Milton, the singer, that named it. You know, and the funny thing was, he was Little Daddy, all right. Although he was a big ass football player. But the Bachelors. None of us were bachelors. We were all married. And that's when I met my now wife. You know, she was a young girl, and that was the first thing she pointed out to me with the band. She goes, "Why do you call yourselves the Bachelors? You're all married." Well, we're not going to call ourselves Little Daddy and the Married Guys. You know?
Right. So if you don't mind, tell me the story, because again, I feel like there's not enough information about this out there. I should know, as a big fan of your work, how did you meet Cheech?
Cheech, well, I got fired from Motown. I realized every move I made was because I was fired or kicked out of somewhere. Like, we got kicked out. We started the band in Calgary, and then the mayor and the chief of police actually kicked us out of Calgary.
We were asked
to leave.
Oh my God!
During the Christmas rush, and we were glad to leave. And then when I was out in Vancouver, after the gigs ran out, because we were sort of, you know, we weren't a professional band. We were like a bunch of guys thrown together that could play rock and roll. And so we had no idea about the touring, you know, how you tour different. We never had an agent.
Okay, right.
We would just get gigs. And then when the gigs were finished, like Little Daddy, you know, we broke up because we never had any work ahead of us. And so all of us are so used to being fired that we just got fired ourselves. And so I ended up, going back, and then I ended up. I got fired from Motown. That was my latest one. After I wrote a hit song for them, I got fired because I had to get a green card, and the tour manager didn't know what that meant. And so when I missed a gig, he fired me. And even though Motown was paying for it, but when I got fired, I stayed fired. And I went back to Vancouver, and I started a theater company in a strip joint. And then we had another actor like me, long hair. And then we had a straight guy. And then our straight guy's wife found out what he was doing. And so she fired him. And then that's when I met Cheech. Cheech was in Vancouver. He was avoiding the draft. And he was also looking for a job. And so when I met him, I hired him at first as a writer and as an actor, writer-actor. Well, everybody was writer-actors, you know, that's the way it was. And so, and then when we got fired from my brother, my brother fired us because we had played out our string in Vancouver. We started attracting the non-drinkers.
Uh-huh.
And for a bar, that's death, you know, because they take up room that the alcoholics need, you know, to spend all their paycheck.
Yeah.
And so we got fired from there. And so then Cheech and I came to L.A. to make it as comedians.
Wow.
And that's how we did it.
And so you're at the club and you just needed some entertainment and you figured, why not comedy? Was it that simple or was it a little more involved than that?
No, it was a strip club. And,
yeah.
And the girls would come on with these elaborate costumes, and I noticed that crowd really wasn't interested in the show.
Sure.
They were just, they liked the atmosphere, and the girls would get on stage and get naked, and it wasn't really a show. It was just a party where chicks got naked.
Okay.
And so I decided that, and we had a singer and we had a tap dancer, you know, emceeing the show, but no one was watching them. And so when I came home without a band, I started working the lights and writing shows. And then I realized, hey, I could write a show with the strippers because I noticed that they were so beautiful before they got into their costumes. And so I wrote the first show was about after the show, and we're having a pajama party at one of the girls' house. And so the girls would come in their street clothes one by one, and then they would undress and get into their pajamas or their little sexy, what are they called? I forget what they're
lingerie?
Called. Nightgown.
Sure, okay.
And and then Taps would come over with Jeannie, the singer, and they would say, hey, that was a great night we had tonight. Hey, Taps, why don't you show us that dance you did? That was amazing. So Taps would do his dance, and then now the whole crowd is looking at him. And he was so good that he got an encore. And so he had to do two acts.
Wow.
And at the end of the show that night, he quit because he wasn't hired to do his act. He just wanted to be the MC and
wow.
not do anything. And so, you know, we lost our entertainment. And so I talked to the doorman, who was, you know, Dave Graham. He was a very funny guy. And so I said, I wanted him to take over Taps's place. And so David said, I'll do it if you do it. He put it on me. And so I said, oh, okay. So we became a comedy team, David Graham and myself. And then then the rest was history. We started doing improvisational comedy, and we just never looked back. And when Cheech and I joined up, we did the same bits, you know, that we would do in the show. And only Cheech and I did them, you know, back to back, and we tried it out in Vancouver at a Battle of the Bands, and we actually won the contest without playing a note. It was just Cheech and I doing comedy.
Oh my God!
And so we knew then that I knew, you know, I'd been through the Motown school of hard knocks, and so I knew what it took, you know, and two guys without instruments, you know, can make a lot of money more than a band with a ton of expenses.
Right. Wow. So you essentially do this weird thing where you invent an artsy form of burlesque, basically. Like, that's kind of what happened. And then you just...
Yeah.
It doesn't fall into your lap, but you must have felt like you had an aptitude for making comedy, and then you meet the guy who just is a perfect complement to your work. What was the material like then? Is there anything like it on any of your albums, or was it totally different? What was the act like?
Not a whole lot. Nothing on the albums. No, what happened when we were playing for, you know, bikers and strip clubs, we would torture the bikers, you know. We would do some very classical bits. And you know, bikers expecting hardcore strippers, and they would get... like we had a mime artist, we had a classical guitarist, and the mime artist would come out and pretend he's picking flowers. And then we had Dave would come out and pretend to sing a very classical song. And then I would start the humor by coming out through a door, pretending that I was half asleep with a rolled up newspaper and stripped to the waist. And it looked like I'd walk over to Dave and I'd beat him beat him about the head with a newspaper and saying, "What kind of fucking song is that?" And that would start the humor, and then we would go into all sorts of humor. So, but our material was more tits and ass, you know, sex, a lot of sex jokes. In fact, we got a lot of material from the Playboy joke column.
Okay,
you know, we would act out their jokes, you know, and so when Cheech and I ended up in L.A., the only common denominator was getting high, smoking dope. That was the one thing everybody related to. And then plus the fact Cheech was Latino, you know, Mexican and Chicano. And so we added the Chicano character and the stoner character. And that really resonated with the world. And then when we did Up and Smoke, that really cemented it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that was really the birth of Cheech and Chong.
That's so crazy. What was your experience? I know you might not be able to speak to Cheech's experience, but what was your experience with improv? Was it just like a necessity? You're just like, I'll figure it out as I go along? Or did you have any experience with it?
No, other than watching it. But, you know, being a musician, you know, and a lot of the improv actors that I met over the years, most of them had music experience.
Okay.
Because what you learn in music is you learn how to improvise, you know. You get a theme, and then you improvise off that theme.
Sure.
Or you create a new song, you know. And so jokes are just like music, you know. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. And, you know, you have a punchline, and then you can, then you go on to the next set, you know. So I would write a set like I would do a music set, you know, different songs, but it would be comedy.
Yeah.
Different comedy bits. And so I just use my musical training and the comedy. It's all about timing and I had a natural thing for it. And so did Cheech, you know, cause Cheech would entertain his family. I was a watcher. When I was playing on the Chitlin circuit, they always had a black comic opening.
Sure.
You
yeah.
know, the black clubs always had comics and MCs, you know, people that would talk to the crowd, you know, not like, you know, and it was very hip.
Yeah.
And like Red Fox and that. It's like it is today, you know, like Chris Rock. It'd be like Chris Rock going on before the strippers, you know, and doing his bit. And so I was lucky enough to be part of that world. Earlier, you know, in the early 60s, the late 50s and early 60s. And so I had that ability, you know, to entertain. And that's really what got us the kind of success that we ended up doing.
That's crazy. I love hearing stories when people don't intend to get into comedy and yet all they got to do is try a little hard at comedy and they're just great at it. I mean, that's one of the, it's great. I love stories like that.
Well, my early training, I played guitar when I was 8 years old and I used to play with a fiddle player. I played with him for about 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. And it was background guitar second guitar, you know, rhythm guitar. And he told me right from the beginning, keep it simple. He'd say, keep it simple and give the people what they want, you know. And so I just used that creed through my life, and it always worked.
Yeah.
You know, because the simpler that Cheech and Chong became, the more basic we were, the more popular we became.
Sure.
Because everybody understands simple, you know. The intellectuals and the people that aren't so smart. You know?
Yeah.
And the trouble that I saw with some of these more intelligent comedians is that they're cracking, you know, themselves up, but they're leaving a lot of audience in the dark, you know, not knowing you know what they're talking about.
Sure.
Whereas when Cheech and Chong, you know, there was never a doubt as to what we were trying to say, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would argue that at the very least, though, that doesn't exclude any of your comedy that also kind of got deep, whether or not the material was. I mean, you guys were saying some I don't know. You maybe. I mean, do you think you were saying anything daring? Because I mean, you're pretty anti-authority, oh, yeah. You know.
Well, it's not so much anti-authority as it is pro-hipness.
Yeah. Okay.
It's something that you know, to me, you know, anti-authority. I look at this, cops are people, you know, and it's been my experience that it's better to be friends with those guys than it is to piss them off.
Sure.
You know, so I had a lot of police. We do. Cheech's dad was a cop.
Uh-huh.
He was like he taught law enforcement. He was right up there. And so Cheech was raised by a serious policeman.
Mm-hmm.
And so cops became our big fans, you know, because we never were anti anything. We were just pro pot.
Okay. All right. I get that. I get so even if you're doing like Stadenko, I guess he's not even the bad guy in that sketch. He's just kind of boring.
Well, he just had to learn.
Yeah.
You know, what he did in the movie. The great thing right. about Cheech and Chong movies is that nobody got hurt. And nobody got killed, and nobody, you know, we never tried to turn anybody into drug addicts, you know.
Right.
We were just trying to do our life. It was like a day in the life of a couple of stoners, you know.
Sure. Well, I think maybe. I don't know. I'm trying to think of what my favorite part of your albums is, because that's the stuff I grew up on for the most part. And I,
oh yeah,
I grew up with it late. You know, this is stuff my parents owned and passed on to me.
And you're curious and
sure.
You're a writer, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you had to experience, or you have to learn about everything.
Exactly.
You know? And so when your friends would talk about Cheech and Chong, you had to go check it out.
You know,
and then when you were ready for that kind of information, you would understand it as you grew older.
I think that's true. Well, you know, what's funny is I'll say at the very least, we were super proud. My best friend and I became best friends over Weird Al's music and over your comedy. And we were the first kids in the neighborhood to discover Cheech and Chong. So but what's funny is we were probably the last kids in that town to ever smoke pot. I'm almost certain of that, which is funny because... You know, but that never mattered to us. I think it was just like how good your comedy was, you know, the characters, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was, we had so much fun doing it because we were always stoned, but not, you know, not just blotto stoned. We'd get high enough to appreciate what we were doing.
Yeah.
And so we would have more fun listening to their albums, I think, than the audience did. Because we would we would create it and then sit back and listen over and over again. And then we would say, oh, well, we got to fix this and make this a little better and that a little better. And it was always done for love.
Yeah.
Cheech and Chong, everything we did was for the love of humor. It wasn't for them, you know, thinking, well, CBS will buy this we can do this. You know, we're clean. We never thought about being clean or dirty. We just thought about being funny.
Yeah. Well, and that's what's funny is that then people like myself can come along and say, man, you took all these chances with language when it's like, no, this is what we thought worked. Right?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
So, sometimes it's hard because guys like myself tend to get up our own ass when we're thinking about stuff we love, you know?
Well, you guys are analytical, you know, and you know the rules and that's why you enjoy it more, because then you understand exactly what rules we're breaking, you know?
Right.
And then you understand what rules are really full of shit, you know, what are real.
That's exactly true. I think one of the things that's inspired me the most is, you know, when I made my first comedy album, I was 19, and my favorite thing was cutting together all the sound effects and doing all that shit myself. And I know you had Lou Adler, but I was curious, like, what was the production process like of those albums? Because they are some of the best mixed albums I've ever heard.
Well, exactly what you said. What we did, Lou would only get the product after we had it have nailed down, basically.
Okay.
And then we'd send it to Lou. Then we'd send it to Lou, and he'd give me his notes. He'd phone me in the middle of the night and give me his notes. And then we always gave him the bits to do the music. Cheech and I never did the music. It was Lou Adler. That was his expertise.
Sure, okay.
And so that was our method. But Cheech and I always, you know, we were the ones that did the sound effects, and we had fun doing them, you know. We knew where to put them and how to put them, and then we played with them, you know, the sound and everything. We had the best time.
Man, I didn't know you did the sound effects yourself. That changes things so much for me.
To be alone. Huh?
Sorry, I just didn't know you did the sound effects yourself. That kind of just blew my mind. That blew the fuck out of my mind. Sorry for the language, but holy shit. That's amazing. Yeah. So what were you, I guess, let's get a little technical. What were you carrying? Were you going around to places, or were you doing all the effects in a studio?
Sometimes we would, you know, like when we did the drive-in bit, we went to a drive-in movie theater, last one in L.A., and
wow.
We recorded us driving over the bumps.
Mm-hmm.
We recorded that sound, and then like gunshots, for instance, we would get the security guard at A&M Records, and we'd get him to fire his gun off in a bucket of sand or something.
Oh,
you know?
My God.
And just to get the sound. And if we needed streets, that was easy. If we needed kids, I had all my kids, and they would get their friends, and we would all end up in a studio, you know, making sound effects and singing and that. And my, like one time, the tortured old man bit, we needed a woman screaming.
Uh-huh.
And so that was my wife, Shelby.
Uh-huh.
We had her in the studio. We wanted her to scream. She screamed. And, yeah, we had so much fun. You know, it was just, if we could go back to those times, I'd go back in a minute. But
yeah.
Unfortunately, we got bit by the movie bug. And when you start doing movies, it's the ultimate. You can't. You physically can't go back. You know?
Sure. Well, I mean, at the very least, we've got this example of a bunch of albums that have, I think, a lot of heart and obviously a lot of work went into them that are going to stand the test of time, at least even in terms of just the technical stuff. Like, I think you could just listen to those for the technical stuff and be really heavily involved in it.
Yeah, if you're into that thing. And you know, I think one of the biggest accomplishments is that we've influenced so many artists, you know, like Quentin Tarantino. He's a big Cheech and Chong fan.
Yeah.
And you can see our mark on all his movies. You know, they always had this Chong sort of attitude.
Yeah.
In them. And then we've influenced like Howard Stern. You know, Howard Stern was like you. He grew up on our albums. And so he went right to the, you know, right to the hardcore, you know, radio stuff.
Yeah.
And
do you?
And what else was I going to say?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No. Well, I was actually going to ask you, of your albums, do you have a favorite one?
Not really.
No.
Not really. They all sort of. Let's see. Favorite albums? Probably the first one.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, because that was such a milestone. You know, that first album represented all our struggles, you know, trying to make it. I mean, Cheech and I, you know, we struggled for about 2 years, and it was a struggle. You know, when you try to support your family, or two families in my case, you know, luckily both of my women worked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had jobs. And so Cheech and I, we just did the couch, you know, sleeping on friends' couches. And putting up with, you know, Three Dog Night really helped, too, because they were, the drummer, Floyd, is a brother-in-law of mine, I was married to his sister. She was my first wife. And so they opened a few doors for us, you know. But all in all, it was just a labor of love, the whole trip.
Yeah. And that whole time that you were waiting for that to happen, was it just doing club gigs or opening for acts?
Everything we could go.
Everything you could get. Okay.
Everything we could get. They never had comedy clubs then. And so we would go to the black clubs, and then they would hire us, you know, for $25 or $50, you know, some real cheap price, mm-hmm. And we could rely on them, you know, and that's what kept us alive for a year, two years, you know. Yeah. And we'd do any freebies that we could do, and then we, you know, we couldn't go on the road because we were, you know, saddled with family, but we could stay in town, and then but it was a recording. As soon as we did Dave's Not Here, then we got jumped into that upper echelon of comedy.
Yeah.
You know, because when you have usually you're in comedy for years before you do an album. But Cheech and I were only in it for maybe a year before we started doing recordings.
Wow.
And the way we did it, you know, most comedians, you know, they record their act.
Right.
Their live act.
Right.
But we were opposite. We recorded an album, you know, and it was all about, you know, being hippies in this, you know, in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was all about. And drugs, anything to do with drugs. We cornered the market on that. And then we did kind of material that, you know, the only kids could understand. You know, they couldn't play it for their parents.
Right.
Although some did.
Sure.
You know, a lot did. And then if you do anything forbidden, that's another key to success, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I love that you're able to break it down so succinctly about what worked about your comedy. That's kind of great to me. I mean, it seems simple, but at the same time, obviously, it wouldn't have worked if you guys didn't have this huge love for writing sketch comedy, which is a thing I don't get to see as much anymore.
Yeah, yeah, it sort of faded away, you know. Like, the committee had a movie out, and I don't think it even got distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, people forget. You know, and then the comedians, they copy, like, the Sam Kinison model. That's out, you know.
Yep, sure.
Now, you know, and although Richard Lewis, his style is, there's one, Carmichael, is that his name? Black guy. He's doing that sort of, like, train of thought.
Oh, sure, yeah. Gerard, you know? Carmichael?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Like, he's carrying on that tradition.
Yeah.
You know. Steve Martin, you know, his style is gone. We haven't seen that, you know, wild and crazy guy model anymore. You know, like I said, Kinison, Andrew Dice, he has to change his act, kind of.
Sure.
You know, you can't rely on. You see, you can't get. You can. What you do, you raise a crop of admirers, and it's an age thing. And when they grow out of you, then it's time to move on because. You got to make way for the new comics coming up that have their audience.
Yeah.
Know?
But you still,
yeah, it's always a system. Yeah.
You still got a pretty diehard fan base though. And at the very least you get to perform for them, you know, on occasion. Right. I mean, what's that like?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, over the years, you know, I've developed, just myself, you know, Cheech too, but I developed, like, there was a what's it called? That 70s show time, you know, period of my life.
Yeah, yeah.
Five years of my life was the 70s show, 6 years, you know. And so I got a lot of fans from that.
Sure.
Then I got fans from Dancing with the Stars, you know.
Oh, right,
got,
yeah.
Yeah, millions of fans that just know me as a dancer.
That's and, amazing.
And then, you know, the old Cheech and Chong fans, you know, they see me go through all my changes. And so, yeah, we've managed to stay pretty much relevant even to today. Now I'm into the weed business, and which is so natural for me.
Sure.
But it's not something where I just put my name on it and, you know, forget about it. But I go around and I promote it. And now I'm getting more into a heavy spiritual side of it all. And like I just came back from... Berlin, and they had me do a little talk, and the talk really was about how marijuana cures, and the cure starts in the brain, you know. Mm-hmm. The brain is the central command post for us, you know, and it's the brain is also where the soul is stored, you know, the consciousness is stored.
Yeah.
And so I did a whole talk about how we are pure consciousness, and therefore everybody is relevant, you know, because everybody on earth is necessary to be here.
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah.
And that's why you have to respect everybody's journey, regardless of what it is, regardless if it's robbing banks or if it's you know, preaching to the followers. Whatever it is relevant.
Yeah.
And you can't really make any kind of distinction as to what is good, what is bad, because everything is relevant. And the basis to that is because we are immortal beings. You know, we've always been here. We will always be here. And so all we're doing is learning, learning how to live. And
yeah.
It takes a few lifetimes to learn, say, on Earth, you know, but we're learning, and some aren't, you know, some are still in kindergarten and some are, in advanced university.
You know,
but everybody has a right to be here, and everybody, and no one has a right to criticize.
I like that. I like that, and I like that we've actually kind of, I feel like that's been a theme through what we've talked about this whole time. I mean, like, you gave me a pretty good idea of your own journey, which has been, I don't know, insane, like filled with luck, filled with misfortune, but it's all led to stuff that you learned how to appreciate.
Exactly.
You know?
Like I said, I got fired to every position. In fact, I wrote a movie one time called The Peter Principle.
Mm-hmm.
It was about two rock fans who sneak into a concert by pretending they're roadies,
mm-hmm.
and end up getting a job as roadies. But they're so inept that they keep getting promoted instead of fired. Like, they drop equipment, so they go, oh, take them off that, put them in charge of driving, and then they show up late, you know, and so they end up being guitar techs, and then they mess that up, and they end up performing.
Yeah.
And they end up becoming the star because they're so inept to be doing anything else.
Yeah.
And that really is life. You know, that's what we usually do. We sort of like, and the only law of the universe is karma, which is cause and effect. That's the only law. You know, if you plant bad seeds, you will suffer. If you plant good seeds, you will prosper. So that really is the simplest way to look at everything. And the thing is that I have to learn. And that's why I said, you know, to you, what do you want to know? Because you can't really tell people, you can't give people directions unless they ask for it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure, I do.
And that's really what preaching's all about. You know, if someone comes to me and asks me like you did, I'll gladly give anything I know. But, you know, to walk up to a stranger or to someone that's on another path and to start sprouting my philosophies, it's unwanted, and it wouldn't be learned. It wouldn't be accepted. So that's what I learned. You know, stay on your own towel. That's
yeah.
what the yogas say.
You know, I like that a lot, and I like that. I like knowing that guy, the guy that's in your head, that you are the guy who created just some of my favorite comedy of all time, because you people can call it stoner comedy if they want. I look at it, again, I might be up my own ass about this, but I look at it a little more deeply than that. I think it's great character comedy that happens to have pot in it, and the pot's fine. If that's what brings you in, great. But the character comedy is my favorite part, and it's obviously got the heart of the two of you in it. I really do love that.
And it's done with love.
Yeah,
if you notice, you know, we don't. There's no hate. There's no meanness involved. You know, even the killing the girl tonight, old man. You know, the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is some of the most favorite. What's his name? Quentin Tarantino. Listen to that over and over again when he wrote Inglourious Basterds.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
But you know what I mean?
I do.
I mean, yes, it was showing Nazis killing Jews, but there was comedy with it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was comedy in the camps. There was a ton of comedy in the camps because, like I said before, you know, we're immortal beings, and this is just a stage of life that everyone's going through, and being caught up in the Holocaust is just one of them, you know.
Right.
And realizing that, you know, and so if you if you have that knowledge, a lot of us aren't supposed to have that knowledge, you know, or else you wouldn't do what you do. You know, you have to come to this epiphanies all by yourself. And
yeah,
and that's about all I can say.
Well, and that's perfect. I will say, you mentioned something about planting good seeds. I'm going to thank you very, very much from the bottom of my heart for planting a million good seeds in my brain and for making me want to keep making comedy. I mean, if it wasn't for your comedy, I wouldn't be doing this. I wouldn't have this show. My life wouldn't be the same. So it really does mean a lot to me.
I appreciate that. You take care.
Thank you so much. Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.
A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.